Welcome back to New Books in Islamic Studies. Thanks again for joining us. I'm your host, Christian Peterson. I just had the pleasure of speaking with Brett Wilson about his great new book, Translating the Quran in the Age of Nationalism, Print Culture and Modern Islam in Turkey, which was published with Oxford University Press in 2014. Muslim debates regarding the translation of the Quran are very old. However, during the modern period, they became heated because local communities around the globe were rethinking their relationship to scripture in new social and political settings. In this new book, Wilson provides a rich history of how this conversation is unfolding within the late Ottoman period and Republic of Turkey. The Quran's translatability is contested from various perspectives, both old and new, but emerging print technologies, shifting political authority, and changing economies of knowledge production offer contemporary challenges that mark the demand for Turkish translations. Wilson narrates the production of vernacular interpretations and commentaries, unofficial translations, and a state-sponsored project. In many cases, translation was viewed as a tool of progress, modernization, and Turkish nationalism. For others, it led to vernacular ritual practice and disharmony in the global Muslim community. He also investigates the role of religious authorities, lay community members, publishers, calligraphers, Protestant missionaries, Arab neighbors, and government in the creation and rejection of Turkish translations of the Quran. In our conversation, we discuss print technologies, vernacular commentaries, shipping and trade, Ottoman politics, secularism, Arab nationalism, everyday ritual worship, and arguments about the Quran's translatability. It's a really wonderful book, and Brett has done an excellent job in providing us this snapshot in the history of the Quran. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Brett Wilson. Thanks again for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies. Brett, how you doing?
Very well. Thank you, Christian. Great to be here.
Yeah, thanks for joining me. This really is a wonderful book. You're spanning lots of interesting topics in terms of modernity and nationalism and Islamic unity and material culture and textual analysis. So you're really doing a lot in this book, and I'm excited to talk to you about it. So thanks for writing a wonderful book.
My pleasure.
Before we get into the details, the tradition here at New Books in Islamic Studies is to find out a little bit about the authors. So I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about how you got interested in Islamic studies, if there were perhaps mentors that shaped either the topics you explore or your approach that you take, any kind of moments that really locked it in for you as this is what you want to do.
Sure. Well, I was very interested in the Middle East as an undergraduate, and I happened to have a couple of friends at my university who were Turkish, and these two things combined led to me studying abroad in Istanbul as a junior year student. So I studied at Boğaziçi University in Istanbul for a year, and I actually went there also with quite a lot of interest in Byzantine history. But over the course of my time there, I really became more and more interested in Turkey and the Ottoman Empire. I ended up learning Turkish while I was there, and this kind of set the path for me as an undergraduate. Then after graduating, one of my undergraduate advisors thought, you know, you've got this background and you've got Turkish language, so why don't you think about doing graduate school in Islamic studies? And it's interesting because I had very much wanted to do that, but this was at the time right after the 2001 economic crisis in the U.S., and everyone was speaking very badly about the prospects for a career in academia. Mm. So I thought really that it wasn't an option, but when this advisor pushed me in that direction, I went with it, and then I ended up matriculating to Duke University in the Islamic Studies program there.
Now, could you talk a little bit about how this particular project emerged? Because it did begin in your dissertation research. So perhaps what was going on while you were doing your graduate studies, and then how you might have had to rethink the dissertation in the preparation of the book itself?
Sure. Well, one thing that happened was that, of course, while I was working on the dissertation, there were a lot of new developments in the translation of the Quran. In Turkey, several new versions came out. A very important older translation was found and published. So there were some kind of exciting things going on. But also, I would say I came to the topic, you know, obviously through my interest in Ottoman and Turkish history. But then again, my advisor, Bruce Lawrence, played a big role in encouraging me to investigate the importance of translations of the Quran, what they've done in Turkey, what their relevance and their role is in modern Islam more broadly. So that's how the dissertation happened. I spent a good, you know, many months in the Ottoman archives doing research on this in order to try to get kind of different perspective on the history of the Quran as a book. Much of the literature on the Quran is obviously about the content, which, you know, I'm also extremely interested in. But for this dissertation, and then later the book, I really wanted to try to find out more about the history of the context of the Quran, or the kind of cultural history of the Quran. And so by going to the Ottoman governmental archives, I was able to find a really rich array of stories, sources, developments, etc., related to the Quran as a material object, as a book that was printed, as a book that was distributed by the government, that was sometimes protected by the government, etc. And that was one of the things happened during the research. In terms of turning the dissertation into a book, this took me quite a long time because I really think about them a bit separately, because the book is more than twice as long as the dissertation. So it was really a substantial doubling and plus some in terms of length, in terms of research, etc. And that happened over the course of several years while I was working at McAllister teaching, and I had a sabbatical, which I spent in Turkey, which was very helpful for expanding it. And a lot of rethinking on my part, reframing, reading sources that I had not had the chance to get to, and, you know, obviously composing several new chapters as well.
What I find really interesting about this book, and if you just read the title, you might miss it, especially the first half of the title, right? Translating the Quran in the Age of Nationalism. You might assume that this book is looking at kind of the content and exactly how translations occurred. But what I really found fascinating about this book is that you're basically looking at this as a process and the debates that are surrounding this process. So it's the social activities, the social consequences of the activity of translation. And it's really great, Brett. So thank you. You begin the book, though, kind of setting it up that while these debates are happening in the modern period, there's been previous debates about the translatability of the Quran. Just to kind of give us some broader context and set this up for listeners, how would you describe kind of the historical debates regarding the translation of the Quran?
Sure. Well, very early in the history of Islam, of course, there was a state that was expanding, and there were people converting or encountering non-Arab populations who were interested in the Quran, or who Muslims wanted to teach about the Quran. And so very early on, there are these this question of the licitness of translating the Quran becomes an issue. It first crops up dealing with the issue of how to say the obligatory daily prayers. So could a Persian Muslim or a new convert to Islam say their prayers in a language other than Arabic? And also, could they recite the verses of the Quran which are required in the prayer in a language other than Arabic? Travis Zadeh has written a fantastic book in the same series as my book that really goes deeply into this topic. I think you've read it as well, Christian. And of course, it comes to the question of, well, is the Quran miraculous language that cannot be imitated or reproduced? Or is it a message with content that does have some translatable parts which are viable to translate? And without going too much further into it, I would just say that the vast majority of Muslim legal scholars tended to go to the side that translation is, perfect translation that is not possible. Some would say that translation is not licit or is impermissible, but that, you know, certain summaries or interpretive reworkings of the Quran are licit. So this is kind of the broad issue. And of course, coming up to the modern period, these issues were still very much live, were very relevant, because in the late Ottoman Empire, for example, it was impossible to publish a book with the title Translation of the Quran. And so the very word translation still had that kind of prohibitive element to it, even as late as the, you know, the 1920s in Turkey.
Now, in the 19th century, you kind of begin your story, and in this kind of nexus of new print technology, shifting political authorities, different or kind of emerging modes of knowledge production, we have kind of a more focused debate on the translatability of the Quran. Can you tell us some kind of the historical context that we would need to make sense of this? What's going on in this kind of late Ottoman period? Why does translation become a topic of interest again? How does print technology kind of fit into this?
Certainly. Well, the issue of print technology is crucial in that, first of all, there's a huge, before the issue of translation comes up, the issue of printing the Quran is a major focus of concern over the course of the middle of the 19th century. And that's because in various countries or empires around the Ottoman Empire, there are Muslims and non-Muslims printing copies of the Quran in Arabic, obviously, original copies. And these books are becoming mass-produced, they're becoming much cheaper, etc. But in the Ottoman Empire, they're still illegal up through the 1870s. So there, I have this argument in the book that it becomes more and more normal to expect to own a copy of the Quran. And combined with that, there is the issue that the copies of the Quran that eventually the Ottoman state agrees to produce and print have an official stamp of approval and usually have also the name of the Sultan in the back. So I also argue that these printed Qurans that emerge in the 19th century really link a kind of relationship with the state, with Muslim identity. And I contend that that is that lays the foundation for thinking about a national Quran, a Quran that is related to national identity in addition to these printed texts. Additionally, we have to think about things like education. And the 19th century was the period in which, for the first time, there was a broader effort to institute state schools across the Ottoman Empire. So rising literacy rates, increasing number of people who expect to own a Quran. And of course, we began to see the efforts of Christian missionaries in the Middle East in the 19th century. And one of their major activities is producing translations of the Bible, translations for vernacular consumption among the populations of the Middle East. So there is, so to speak, a model of what a vernacular printed text is and what it can do and the power it can have. In addition to all these things, there were also models from Europe, and much of the Ottoman intelligentsia in the 19th century was reading French. And many of them were reading French translations of the Quran as well, because at that point there wasn't a similar text in Turkish to read. And so many of them thought that these affordable, accessible French language texts were quite a good model for what could be the case in Turkish or in the Ottoman Empire. For the purposes of educating people about the Quran, for the purposes of promoting more, so to speak, rational ways of engaging the Quran, instead of just reciting it, which was the traditional education. I think I got to most of your points there. Yeah. That's a broad subject. I can say more if you like.
Yeah, of course. So, maybe we can zoom in here a little, because there was some hesitation to have printed Qurans. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about this. So what type of Qurans did people have? How were they produced before printing? What was the kind of response by Muslims to printed Islamic materials more broadly, in the Quran specifically? And when did the Ottomans, and why did they start allowing for printed Qurans to happen?
Certainly. Well, books in general were quite expensive before printing really took hold. So we're talking about scribes reproducing these texts. And even a rather plain, mediocre copy of the Quran done by some not-so-special calligrapher would have been quite an expensive object for most people in the Ottoman Empire. There are some really interesting studies done about the estates of people, what they owned when they died. And we see that, for example, for members of the ulama, many of them had few possessions, and usually they owned one or two, maybe a few more books, and the Quran was usually among them. But, for average people, usually that wasn't the case. Usually they didn't own any books. They were out of reach. And I've tried to estimate how valuable copies of the Quran actually were in the book. It's an imprecise science, but roughly the middle of the 19th century would have been equal to about the price of a cow for a cheaper copy and about the price of two cows for a more expensive copy. So if you think about how many books you've ever bought that took, for example, 10 days wages or 20 days wages, it's probably very few. Probably zero. And this was the same case then. So books were simply unaffordable. So what happened was, when Russian Muslims, when publishers in India, when publishers in Iran began to print copies of the Quran starting in the 1820s, 1830s, for the Russian Empire, even in the late 18th century, these books were circulating. People were bringing them to sell in the Ottoman domains because they were cheaper. They were more accessible. A lot of times they were also easier to read. They were clearer. And so there becomes market pressure, actually, on the Ottoman Empire to accept printing, because they were illegal. They basically confiscated these imported copies of the Quran for several decades. We have hundreds of documents about border officials seizing copies of the Quran from booksellers, from refugees, from smugglers, etc. And they would confiscate these books, send them to Istanbul, and store them in a depot somewhere. And what happened was, the state realized that this was unsuccessful because they couldn't really stop the flow of these books. And moreover, they began to realize that there was a real need for the Ottomans to, so to speak, make their presence felt in the domain of producing printed Qurans. So after after several decades of confiscating the books, of trying to keep them out, the state decided to produce them and essentially to officially approve certain versions and put the Sultan's name in the back. And these were certified official acceptable Qurans, which also were then sent abroad to other places in order to bolster the Sultan's claim to be the caliph of all Muslims, to promote kind of pan-Islamic sympathies among Muslims in various parts of the globe. And the Ottoman archives have very interesting documents about sending copies of the Quran to Indonesia, to South Africa, to China, to Afghanistan, virtually everywhere where Muslims were living. So it was part of also a kind of state legitimacy campaign to actually realize the claim of being the caliph at that time.
Now, alongside the proliferation of printing and specifically these printed Qurans, we have new vernacular interpretations of the Quran happening. What types of commentaries do we find? What types of audiences are these intended for? You kind of have alluded to different types of audiences and kind of a new craving for Quranic materials. What's going on here with these commentaries?
Sure, right. So before we see outright translations, we have this period of what I would call simplified commentaries or easy-to-read commentaries. And these were, for the most part, translations of commentaries from Arabic and Persian. And the consumers were, it's hard to tell a lot of times the reception of these books, but what we do know is that, for example, for a very popular early translation, Turkish translation of a Persian commentary, the primary recipients were madrasa students. So members of the ulama who were studying in schools who obviously needed such books, had a high demand for these books. And also we can imagine these new graduates of various state schools, institutions, using these books. So there are two really prominent ones that come out in one in the 1840s, one in the 1860s, which are cited very frequently right up through the mid-20th century. So they really do kind of take hold as accessible sources in Turkish language to, for example, look up the meaning of a particular Quranic verse, to use in your tafsir class, and to use for study and instruction in various types of institutions.
Now, could you tell us a little bit about the debates that are happening at this time? Because this is really when we have these vernacular interpretations and the printing of basically mushafs being reproduced. We have kind of a new invigoration around these debates of should we be translating the Quran? So perhaps you could tell us what are the hesitations at this moment? There are some theological, but there are also kind of nationalist questions that are happening, issues of colonial encroachment that are happening, kind of rise of an Arab unity happening here, and this kind of focus on Arabic as a unifying feature among Muslims. What's going on with the debates in relation to the translation of the Quran during this particular moment?
Sure. Well, what's striking is you really have a change in thinking about the whole issue at this period, which was what really fascinated me. How did this change? What tipped the scales in favor of change? And what you basically have is one camp which holds the traditional line that translations are forbidden or translations are imperfect, and therefore they're not desirable, because of very very linguistic and theological reasons. The Arabic in the Quran is miraculous; it's the direct speech of God, It can't be translated, or if you do translate it, then it loses all of its splendor, so to speak. But increasingly, we start to see voices who argue that it's absolutely indispensable to understand the Quran, and they're really pushing a kind of rational comprehension of the Quran versus the traditional line. And that is pushed in large part, I think, by the view in the period that the Muslim world was in decline and that there needed to be some kind of reinvigoration of connection with the Quran, with the sacred sources of Islam. And so all this is going on. On the side of that, the issue of producing printed copies of the Quran comes down to a very similar question. And that is, by printing the Quran, are you putting the Quran through an impure ritual process on machines that were invented by Europeans? And are you subjecting the Quran to some kind of mechanical violence? This was one of the major issues of concern for people who opposed printing of the Quran. They also opposed the idea that machines and printing houses would basically put scribes out of business, that they would make a lot of these traditional tradesmen unemployed. So there's a combination of a ritual purity argument and also an economic argument connected to it. So all this is happening at the same time. But over the course of the century, really what we see is that arguments for the utility of translation in terms of teaching Islam, helping people to better understand their religion, and in a later phase of spreading Islam around the world and also to the West, the arguments for translation really began to win the day toward the turn of the century, toward the early 20th century.
Now, we have other actors in these debates, and specifically we have people like Muhammad Abduh, Rashid Ridha, who are taking a stance, kind of politicizing translation as a practice. How do they fit into this debate? Right, these debates become international in ways. So,
oh, precisely. So, translations in Turkey and also the promoters of translations in Turkey really alert Rashid Ridha to this current of thought, which is arguing for better understanding of the Quran through translation. Now, despite the fact that Ridha was a reformist and is often thought about as a kind of progressive reformer in some circles, he was firmly opposed to translating the Quran. And he used, on one hand, very traditional arguments about the language, but he also used, as you rightly say, a kind of politicization of the topic. He argues that translations of the Quran will divide the ummah linguistically and basically create national Islams which don't communicate with each other and which are separated. So ultimately, these translations will weaken Islam. But he also says that the translations are based on the models of missionaries and that they are, in a sense, tools of colonial regimes. So he paints them with a very dark brush as being part of a broader effort to divide and conquer the Muslim world. And he wrote quite a lengthy fatwa on this in 1908. His interventions on the topic were in relation to what Turkish-speaking Muslims were doing. And this isn't just Turkish-speaking Muslims in Istanbul or in Anatolia, but also those who were in Cairo. And many different Turkish intellectuals were in Cairo in the period. And of course, there was a Ottoman Turkish elite in Cairo, which remained there for quite a long time. So he was very adamant and pretty consistent, actually, in his opposition to translations. He was a very firm promoter of the revitalization of Arabic as a language for the entire Ummah. And he wrote several very interesting essays about the need to teach Arabic to all Muslims. Essays which actually were not very well received by most Muslim scholars in the period. So Ridda is very, very central in the topic. And he then plays a big role also in kind of establishing positions for understanding translations in the modern period for the opposing camp.
Now, at the same time, on the ground in Turkey, we have kind of shifting social and political circumstances happening. And emerging within this, we have, I'm going to try my best at Turkish here, Bigiyev. Is that correct? So we have this figure, Bigiyev, who basically is the first person to really complete a translation of the Quran. Which we don't have. So this is a really interesting story. So can you tell us about who this figure is, what he was doing, and then kind of the probably more importantly, the broader response to his work and how he positioned the role of translation?
Sure. So Bigiyev is from the same generation as Rashid Ridda. He's a Muslim modernist thinker from Kazan, Russia. But he was deeply involved in the pan-Turkism currents that were circulating at the time, this movement which envisioned a broader Turkic cultural configuration, cultural linguistic configuration spanning from Eastern Europe to Central Asia. And he thought that he was very much in the camp in support of Quran translation. And worked on one for quite a while. But of course, as you mentioned, we don't have it. But what he did do was he wrote a lengthy manifesto in support of translations. And this manifesto, published around 1908, was quite important and quite influential in Istanbul also. And many of his fans and supporters in Turkish-speaking circles, in the Ottoman Empire and also in Russia, really heralded his efforts to be kind of Martin Luther of Islam. Of course, this moniker is used too much, but in the sense that he was actually translating a vernacular Turkish or Turkic Quran for his nation, so to speak, he became a hero and his efforts were trumpeted. Of course, he had many detractors as well. The issue of translating the Quran was divisive right into the Turkish Republic period. It wasn't that there was ever a broad, dominant group that everyone agreed there should be a translation. There were always detractors, and translations faced quite a bit of opposition right up until the foundation of the Turkish Republic. So Bigiyev, he's important for laying down a theoretical foundation and argument for doing translations. And he basically says, look, if we don't understand the Quran, we're not being good Muslims, and we're remaining in a state of ignorance and backwardness, which has put the Muslim world in a terrible position in the first place. So he basically makes the argument utility is quite important. And he also argues that people who say that the Quran can't be translated are basically saying that the Quran has no meaning, i.e., if there's not a meaning that can be communicated in another language, then what are you saying? You're really mystifying the Quran as a text that doesn't have very concrete ethical statements, messages to humanity, so to speak. So this is the gist of what Bigiyev argues. He also makes an interesting variation on traditional arguments for the inimitability of the Quran. And that is, he says that the Quran is inimitable because God protects it, in a sense. He basically extends the logic of the protection of the Quran to translations that, you know, regardless of bad interpretations that people make or mistakes that might be made, the meanings of the Quran are preserved in the Arabic text, so they'll always be there to be retrieved. So we shouldn't fear that a translation will somehow lead to a massive misunderstanding of the text or a loss of some kind of essential meaning, because these have been meditated upon, recorded by the Muslim community for centuries. So there's nothing to fear in translating the Quran.
Now, in the kind of new intellectual environment of the Turkish Republic, we have several translations happening almost immediately after. Can you talk a little bit about what are the changes during this time and what some of these translations look like? What are the responses to them? They're not very well received overall. So what's going on here?
Sure. Well, during the years preceding the foundation of the Republic, which was 1923, there had been several attempts to publish a translation of the Quran. But as I mentioned before, it was illegal. You couldn't do it. The Sheikhul Islam, the head of the Ottoman religious establishment, prohibited doing that. And so once the Republic is founded, that office loses all of its power, and basically the market is opened up for publishing such texts. Now, a broad swath of the devout intelligentsia and the nationalist intelligentsia was very much in support of translation. But what we saw happen in 1924 was that several translations are published, perhaps hastily so, and by a couple of authors who weren't respected as Muslim scholars or even as intellectuals, so to speak. So what happens is these translations are published following quite a bit of advertisements and commercial fanfare during the very first Ramadan of the Turkish Republic. And because they were done perhaps hastily, because they were done by people who weren't respected by the intelligentsia, they received a really brutal reception in the press. And it's a really interesting period to look at because we see basically newspapers and journals publishing extensive criticisms of actual translations of verses and phrases and words in these new books. And overall, they were very hostile, and they thought that not only are they unqualified to do such translations, not only do they make a lot of mistakes, but also the level of Turkish language is not good, they're unpoetic, they even cause Muslims to misunderstand their religion in some sense. So there was one particular verse which really a lot of these debates centered around, and I mentioned it briefly. I discuss it much longer in an article that's coming out, but it's a verse about fasting during Ramadan, and one of the translations translates it in such a way that it could be interpreted that fasting during Ramadan is optional. And several people did write responses to this in the media, which said, you know, look, now we have an accurate translation which says that fasting during Ramadan is optional. And this, of course, caused a big stir. The head of the Diyanet, the religious establishment, issued a proclamation that this was incorrect, that it was a preposterous translation, that it can be considered right, and that, you know, Muslims definitely have to fast during Ramadan. So this is a kind of example of the debates that were happening. It was a fluid public discussion about these verses, which is perhaps unique, at least in the Turkish context, to see the really raising of religious debates to this public forum where Quranic interpretation is being fought out in the domain of newspapers, journals, and other types of printed materials.
Yeah, and Brett, you do a really good job of outlining these various voices and putting them in conversation. And yeah, it's really one of the highlights of the book, how these debates unfold. So extending from this, we then have the Turkish state basically responding by developing their own sponsored translation project. Can you tell us about how this project emerged, who was involved?
Certainly. Well, these first translations, which angered a lot of people, caused various voices to demand that the government sponsor an accurate, eloquent translation, which could be used as a reference, which in some people's mind could be even perhaps an official translation for the Turkish nation. So what happened was the parliament basically set aside funds to sponsor two different people to work on a translation and a commentary, both in Turkish. And it's very clear from the voices at the beginning that what was envisioned was a kind of Martin Luther's German Bible of the Turkish Quran, an accessible, readable, yet poetic and inspiring translation which successfully unites the new Turkish identity and language with the central sacred text of Islam. So, to say the least, expectations were very, very high. And those who sponsored this official translation were very happy with the choice of the translator, because the translator was one of the leading devout intellectuals in the late Ottoman Empire, Mehmet Akif Ersoy. He was also a poet. He wrote the Turkish national anthem. He was extremely competent in Arabic. He was the main translator of Muhammad Abdu into Turkish. And so people were very excited that he was going to do the translation. He was seen as the ideal person to do it. Now, what's interesting is that, of course, like many others, he had reservations about a translation, and he had reservations about what the translation might be used for in what was a kind of revolutionary cultural context in the early years of the Turkish Republic. So efforts to perhaps to do Islamic rituals in Turkish rather than in Arabic, efforts to perhaps replace the reading of the Arabic Quran in mosques and in various types of schools with Turkish translations. So there were certain reservations and fears that he had, and basically his story of translating the text became a long, drawn-out saga over many years, and he went to Egypt and lived most of the rest of his life in Cairo, where he worked on the translation. Eventually, he decided that his translation was not ready, and many speculate that he was scared to give the translation to the government because he feared they would use it for some kind of radical religious reform. And so ultimately, he does not submit the translation after working on it for several years. What then happens is the other scholar who was hired to write the Turkish tafsir takes on the project. And this is a gentleman called El Malala Hamdi Yazir, very hard name to say, who was a very respected member of the late Ottoman ulama, a very high-ranking member. And so he was also very well received by the devout intelligentsia as a person to do the project. Now, what's also, of course, the interesting case with him is that he, too, is very opposed to any kind of radical religious reform, and he has deep reservations about using the word translation for his text. And in fact, he won't use that word. He uses the word me'al in Turkish, which is something like a summary or a re-rendering of the Quran. And he writes in the introduction to the work a kind of manifesto against translations, and it's a very curious way that this project went, because it basically showed that despite the fact that it was a single-party regime which had a lot of power, that they really couldn't coerce the religious scholars into producing the kind of translation that they wanted. And they couldn't get them to reproduce the kind of discourse about nationalization that they wanted. So the devout intelligentsia successfully participated in this project, but successfully produced something other than was desired. And what Al-Malala produced was an erudite commentary on the Quran, with translations included. And it became a very important text for the study of tafsir and the Quran in modern Turkey. It's not a text, though, that someone would pick up and read, just to see the meaning of the verses, or as you might with a translation which doesn't have a massive commentary attached to it. It's a multi-volume work, not something that you'd read in your leisure time, so to speak. So ultimately, the attempt to create an official Turkish national translation failed. And this, in a sense, caused some people to be unsatisfied with it. It caused other people to be very happy that a tradition of Turkish tafsir had really been given a very good start in the modern period with this work, and it's still seen as very important. What's interesting is that there's a kind of reputation of Al-Malal's translation in Turkey as being the best translation, despite the fact that very few people have read the original language, because it's quite Ottomanized language, and virtually all the versions now have simplified the language into contemporary Turkish.
Now, people didn't really want to give up on Akif's translation. Can you tell us a little bit about the afterlife of his work?
Sure. There was the question of whether or not Akif had simply stored away his translation somewhere or had actually destroyed it. Now, apparently, he gave orders to his friend with whom he left the translation that if he failed to return from a trip, that he should destroy the translation. Akif went to Istanbul for medical treatment, leaving them in his possession, and Akif never returned. He died in Istanbul. So it was assumed that his friend had destroyed the copies, and several people went to see him in Cairo and ask him, did you actually destroy the translation? And for each visitor, he always said, yes, I destroyed the translation. Then there was a memoir that was published in the 90s, which said that the author had actually been there and witnessed the burning of the manuscripts that Akif had worked on. And for a time, this was kind of assumed to be the final word on what happened. The manuscripts were burned. But the expectation, the hope for this translation became something like a holy grail for many people in Turkey, which they didn't want to give up hope on. And eventually they were proven right. They were proven that one copy of the text, only of a portion, not the entire text, had been preserved. And this came to light in 2013, and this portion was published. And so this long saga, right, of almost 80 years, 80 some odd years, finally came to closure, that the book was published, and now it's being examined and studied and read and debated by a variety of people in Turkey. So it's a long, drawn-out story, but eventually Akif's translation does see the light of day, at least in part.
So the second half of the 20th century, we see the proliferation of various translations, but in very different kind of social contexts. How would you say these Turkish translations have moved forward? How do they relate to these earlier translations, to some of these debates that are happening during the period we've been talking about? What do you see happening? You kind of wrap up the book talking about these newer developments.
Sure. Well, basically, by the second half of the 20th century, by the 1950s, there had emerged, there had developed a culture of translating the Quran. And the taboo was essentially dead. That is, people might still refuse to call their book a translation, but it's very clear that that's what a variety of authors from different schools of thought, from different ideologies, from different religious groups. They were producing translations. And what we start to see is a real sectarianization of the translations. Different groups compose translations for like-minded readers. Now, these might be members of Islamic movements. These might be members of a certain political orientation. These might be various Sufi groups who have their own translations. So the number and the variety of them multiplies exponentially. And so we can you can find every different register of Turkish language, from extremely Ottomanized classical versions to versions which try to avoid using any Arabic roots or Persian root words that are so-called pure Turkish language. And, you know, we see things like newspapers giving away translations of the Quran for subscribing to their newspaper. We see Turkish translations which are published with Arabic facsimiles of famous calligraphic versions of the Quran published in the middle. So it's really quite a variety and quite a liberal sphere of composition and production now for translation. So essentially all the taboos that surrounded printing and composing these books have completely gone by the wayside. And we now see a constantly changing dynamic book market for translations. There are apparently about 800,000 to 900,000 copies of translations sold in Turkey each year over the last 5 to 10 years. We also have the Diyanet, the official religious establishment of the country, producing its own versions, sponsoring its own versions. So there's the official line. There are versions from various groups, movements, political orientations, etc. So it really has become a kind of consumer market of choosing a translation which suits your worldview or your cultural preferences. And that's what we deal with now. And we see each year several new translations coming out. Also, groups like religious minorities like the Alevi, Bektashi, etc. movements have produced a number of their own translations. So I think it also reflects the fact that nowadays, in order to speak authoritatively about Islam in Turkey and also in the rest of the world, you've got to make references to the Quran. You have to have arguments based in the Quran to prove the legitimacy of your viewpoints to be authoritative. So that's what we see has happened in Turkey too. Different groups which might have never engaged much at all in the interpretation of the Quran or tafsir are now widely embarking upon translation projects.
Obviously, there's a lot we were not able to kind of dive into. Thanks for spending some time with us. But before we let you go, we'd love to hear about some of the projects you're working on now or things that you have that will be published soon.
Sure. I'm thinking now a lot about the abolishment of the Sufi orders in Turkey in the early 20th century, and more broadly, the decline of the power of Sufi orders globally. So I'm working on a project about that right now, and I'm spending some time in the archives in Ankara and Istanbul thinking about how we re-envision Sufism in the modern era when Sufi lodges are illegal or at least in a different state of robustness than they had been in previous decades.
Great. Sounds wonderful. Well, thanks for your time, Brett. And we look forward to perhaps talking to you about that project too.
All right, Christian. Thanks a lot. I enjoyed it.
Thanks as always for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies. That was my conversation with Brett Wilson about translating the Quran in an age of nationalism, print culture and modern Islam in Turkey, published with Oxford University Press in 2014. Thanks again.